Thank you for the special music, Mr. Housen. I've been listening to you play piano for a long time, and I mean that as a good thing. I remember Jim in the YOU talent contest. It's fun to hear it continue on. Grandpa Graham will do just fine, thank you. You can call me that if you want. My grandfather was Grandpa Graham, and his father was a Grandpa Graham, and it goes a long way back as long as the first Graham who breached Hadrian's Wall in 1200 AD, I believe. That's the legend we claim. They were always a rowdy bunch. Actually, there was a book written last year called The Despicable Lands or something, and it was about the two Scottish clans who were the rascals and the villains, and it was the Campbells and the Grahams. So we were cow thieves. Much the same as today. Not much has changed, but this is my favorite time of year. I bet there's people in this room who agree with me. It's always been my favorite time of year. I mean, even without thinking about it, it's my favorite time of year. I am happiest, I've decided, when there's lilacs in bloom. They've come and they've gone. But after being in the church for a few years, I realized that what I was talking about was the period of time between the days of unleavened bread and the day of Pentecost. Now, that only works in this part of the world. It doesn't work in the southern hemisphere. But I love that time of year. And I think there's people who would agree with me that in some ways spring begins with Passover, I mean, just mentally. And by the time that Pentecost hits, you know, sometimes it's before or after Memorial Day. But in my own mind, it's kind of the beginning of summer. After that, it just doesn't feel like spring anymore. And that's really the way the gods set it up. I mean, they have to do with harvests and things that are growing. And so that's one way to do it. You can do it with solstices and things like that if you want to. That's perfectly fine. But for me, the time is the time between Passover and Pentecost. Pentecost is the only holy day that doesn't fall on a set day of the Hebrew calendar. Now, the days jump around. The days that we observe jump around on our Roman calendar because the Hebrew calendar has different ways of handling certain things, and they'll sometimes add a month here. So it seems to us that it jumps around. But if you lived your life by the Hebrew calendar, there's only one day that jumps around, and it's Pentecost. The other days are all kaboom, boom, boom on predictable days. And what was the point there? I mean, why not just put it on a certain day of the week? Some people observe it that way. Let's turn to Leviticus 23, which is a chapter that you probably come close to knowing by heart, or at least the organization of it. But I wonder if you've noticed a certain something, because Leviticus 23, section heading, the chapter heading in my own Bible, and it can vary from Bible to Bible, it's not scripture, says appointed festivals, and that's what we associate Leviticus 23 with. And the first thing it talks about is the weekly Sabbath. We know that. And then the second thing, starting in verse 4, it says, these are the appointed festivals of the Lord, the holy convocations, and it's a different category of Sabbaths. And it starts on the first month, on the 14th day of the month at twilight, there will be a Passover offering. And so that section talks about the Passover, and it talks about unleavened bread. Then if you jump to verse 15, it talks about something called the Festival of Weeks, which, of course, we know is Pentecost. Pentecost is a Greek word, so it wasn't called the Festival of Weeks back then. Weeks or sevens or Sabbaths. Sometimes it's called the First Fruits, the Festival of First Fruits. There are many things that we call it. Pentecost, we've been taught, tells us to count 50, but count 50 from what? Why do we count that day? Well, there's a big section in between. It goes on to Festival of Trumpets, Atonement, Feast of Booths, and you think, well, yeah, that's the layout, but there's this big section from verse 9 through verse 14 that sometimes we skim over, because this isn't something that Moses kept. This was something that was added later. We'll see that there. It wasn't kept while they were in the wilderness. It couldn't be. And it's not kept now. It hasn't been kept since there was a temple. And since there is no temple, there's no way to keep it. There's no way to keep it unless we're all organized as an agricultural system doing things together. And that's not the way the world works right now. So we often ignore this. But let's read those verses. The offering of first fruits is what it's headlined in my Bible. And this is not Pentecost, even though it's still called first fruits. It's not Pentecost, but it's very important, especially if you're Jesus. It's really important. Verse 9, the Lord spoke to Moses. So it was delivered back then. Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, when you enter the land that I am giving you. So not at this point. They didn't keep it then. When you enter the land that I am giving you and you reap its harvest, you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest. He shall raise the sheaf before the Lord that you may find acceptance on the day after the Sabbath. The priest shall raise it. On the day when you raise the sheaf, you shall offer a lamb a year old without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. And the grain offering with it shall be 2/10 of an ephah of choice flour mixed with oil, an offering by fire of pleasing odor to the Lord, and the drink offering with it shall be of wine, 1/4 of a hin. You shall eat no bread or parched grain or fresh ears until that very day. And it doesn't mean you can't eat the day before. It means you can't eat things that are taken from the harvest of that year. Before then, not in the wilderness where they're eating manna, but when they're in there and they're in their harvest cycle, they could not eat of the new grain until then, the fresh ears, until that very day, until you have brought forth the offering of your God. It is a statute forever through your generations in all your settlements. So as a principle, it goes on forever. But what is this about? Well, we know. I mean, it's fairly basic. You've heard this before. I don't think this is new to any of you. This is sometimes called the wave offering or the wave sheaf offering. And it makes a difference which one you call it, which I will point out to you. Not scripturally or understanding, but Googling. It makes a big difference. And it was to take place on the day after the weekly Sabbath during the days of unleavened bread. And of course, the Hebrew calendar has its own months and days, set numbers, but just like ours, the 7 days don't always line up with it. So the days of unleavened bread can come on different days of the week. We know this. It's mattered to us when we're trying to figure out the sequence of events, the year that Jesus was actually crucified, because it matters what day of the week the different day, the holy days and other things were on. But this takes place the day after the Sabbath, and that's the weekly Sabbath. And we know it's the weekly Sabbath. It's even though that word can also mean the annual Sabbath, but it's not an annual Sabbath, because if it were an annual Sabbath, then Pentecost wouldn't have to be counted. It would always fall on the same day, and you wouldn't have to do the counting 50 shenanigans. No, it comes on what we would now call a Sunday, the first day of the week, or you know, the sunset on the what we call Saturday, that the first day of the week. It comes on that day. It was meant to be offered then. And certain things were offered. They took first fruits and offered them. The word that says sheaf in my Bible, it can be translated different things, but the word is omer. And omer is a fun word. It can mean many different things. I have good friends in the church. My favorite, absolute favorite piano playing buddy that I've played duets with, we did last year at Lake George. Was that last year? I guess it was, yeah. Is named Michelle Omer. She and her husband Marcus. So Omer is a name that I know, but it's also a Hebrew word. And Omer is the word for that sheaf, that thing that's waved. It doesn't have to mean sheaf. It can mean all kinds of different things. But this time, when we're counting, we start counting from then, and that period of time is called being in the Omer in Jewish tradition. So you have your first day in the Omer, and today would be the 49th day in the Omer. By the time you get to the 50th day, it's not the Omer anymore. In other words, it's in that sheaf period of time. But Omer is the word that they use. So happy 49th day of Omer to you. I'm sorry I didn't wish you a 48th and a 47th, but 49th will have to do. What is the point of the offering of the first fruits? Well, if you Google wave offering, you'll find the Jewish tradition, And it will tell you absolutely nothing. You'll be more confused at the end than you were at the beginning. It has the different things that are done, but you already knew that because you've already read Leviticus 23. But if you Google wave sheaf offering, and I invite you to do it right now, just destroy our United Church of God broadband here in Cleveland. You may pull out your phones and devices and feel free to Google wave sheaf offering, because what comes up is very interesting. The first thing that comes up is a United Church of God article about the wave sheaf offering, about what's going on here. And it's a fine article written by Gerald Ost. It covers everything. There's not much to cover. There isn't much in the Bible about the wave sheaf offering. There's various links that help us understand what it's about. But if you look down, you will see that most of the other references are other what we call churches of God, which in our lingo means Sabbath-keeping groups, people who observe all 10 of the commandments. And this wave sheaf offering is much more important to churches of God than it is to anything else. And the reason it is most important is that we're really the only people, I'm exaggerating. There are other people who would understand it. But we're the only group that really understands what the wave sheaf offering is about. I think we can take not only some pride in that, but some great joy. If you turn, hold your place there, but if you turn to 1 Corinthians 15, and of course you know this as the resurrection chapter, there's no question of what first fruits is a symbol of. And later on, of course, we know that it's a symbol of all God's children receiving his Holy Spirit. But there's a very specific first fruits, and you know this. You know this, but I just want you to see it in print in front of you. In 1 Corinthians chapter 15 and verse 20, we're just going to read one verse just to establish this. It says, "But in fact, Christ has been raised from the dead, the first fruits of those who have died." Now, thankfully, you've been taught well, and I don't have to prove certain things to you, and that would be the chronology of the week that Jesus Christ died. But at any rate, by the time people went to the tomb early in the morning, dawn had already come. It mentions that something had happened. And let's turn to John 20 and get a little light shed on this. This is mentioned in the United Church of God article, by the way, if you want to review it. It's, as I said, it's a very thorough and a very good article. Makes it very clear. But in John 20, there's something curious and specific. Mary Magdalene has gone to the tomb. John 20, early on the first day of the week, while it was still dark, so dawn hadn't taken place at that point, Mary Magdalene came to the tomb and saw that the stone had been removed from the tomb. So Jesus was resurrected at this point. She ran and went to Simon Peter and the other disciple, the one whom Jesus loved, and said to him, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb, and we do not know where they have laid him." And then they came, and then it says in verse 10 that the disciples returned to their homes. But Mary was very affected by this. Mary, it meant a lot to her, and she couldn't make herself leave. And in verse 11, it says, "But Mary stood weeping outside the tomb. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb, and she didn't see something new. This wasn't there before. They would all have seen it. But she saw two angels in white sitting where the body of Jesus had been lying, one at the head and the other at the feet." And these people were sent to tell Mary something, these angels. "They said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping?' And she said to them, 'They have taken away my Lord, and I do not know where they have laid him.' When she had said this, she turned around and she saw Jesus standing there, but she didn't know that it was Jesus. And Jesus said to her, 'Woman, why are you weeping? Whom are you looking for?' She didn't recognize him. There could be many reasons for that. He had been beaten and bruised. He had been injured. It's possible that she just didn't recognize all that. It's possible she had tears in her eyes. We know that she was weeping. She certainly wasn't expecting to see him standing there. So for whatever reason, she didn't recognize this human being. And so she says, supposing him to be the gardener, she said to him, 'Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have laid him, and I will take him away.' Well, Jesus said to her, 'Mary,' and suddenly she knew. She turned and she said to him in Hebrew, 'Teacher.' She knew who it was. And there's, of course, way more bound into that word than we see written here. Jesus said to her, 'Don't hold on to me. Don't touch me. because I have not yet ascended to the Father. But you go to my brothers and say to them, and it's implied, I didn't appear to you, I appeared to Mary, because she hung around. But he doesn't say that. He says, I am ascending to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God. And Mary Magdalene went and announced to the disciples, I have seen the Lord. And she told them that he had said those things to her. So if you turn back to the book of Matthew, because, of course, there's more than one account of this, we find out something else. She couldn't touch him. He was to ascend to his Father. And until he had been presented, he wasn't to be touched. And if my fingers will work, which they will not, apparently. In Matthew 28, it says, after the Sabbath, as the first day of the week was dawning, Mary Magdalene and the other Mary went to see the tomb. Well, there was a lot going on this first day of the week. And if you try to make a chronology out of it, there are some challenges there. But it all happened. And at this time when it happened, it says in verse 8, they left the tomb quickly with fear and great joy and ran to tell his disciples. Suddenly Jesus met them and said, greetings. And they came to him and took hold of his feet and worshiped him. And then Jesus said to them, do not be afraid. Go and tell my brothers to go to Galilee. There they will see me. So one disciple is telling us that he was not to be touched till he went and ascended to his Father. And another disciple is telling us it's perfectly fine to touch him. And he encouraged it, and it was good. So something had happened at that point. And it's the event that is symbolized by the verses in Leviticus 23, to which we shall return. Leviticus 23 and verses 9. Let's read it again, knowing what happened, that Jesus Christ rose from the dead, was raised by his Father God, and left this earth, whether it was leaving the way we think of leaving or whether it was just disappeared from this earth and was in his Father's realm at that point. We don't understand all the details, but he had to go be present with his Father. We know that it didn't take as long as it takes to get to Mars or the moon or things like that, because he was back in a half an hour being hugged. So something happened, and who knows, God's control of time is a little more precise than ours is. Who knows how it happened? I don't. But let's read these words. Jesus went to his Father and was accepted. The Lord spoke to Moses, speak to the people of Israel and say to them. And this, by the way, is that same Jesus who was in the later stories. When you enter the land that I am giving you and you reap its harvest, you shall bring the sheaf of the first fruits of your harvest to the priest, and it matters when you do it. He shall raise the sheaf before the Lord that you may find acceptance on the day after the Sabbath. The priest shall raise it on that first day of the week. This didn't matter to anybody else, and they didn't know why they did it. It mattered because 2,000 years later, it was fulfilled on that specific day. And that's exciting. And it makes all the difference. And we should have picked up on it all along, because it says, on the day when you raise the sheaf, you shall offer a lamb a year old without blemish. And that does appear in other places. That's standard sacrifice rules. If you're sacrificing a lamb, it has to be without blemish as a burnt offering to the Lord. But these people had already sacrificed lambs without blemish. It should have rung a bell. And the grain offering, grain, and the wine offering, wine. Wine, grain, lamb. What is that? Any bells going off in your head? It reminds you of someone who sacrificed their life to pay for the sins and transgressions of the world and was resurrected and lived again. And that's the important part to us, that the sins have been paid for, that Jesus Christ sacrificed so we could be part of the problem. But the important part for Jesus, let's face it, is that he was living again. And that he went to see his Father, his best friend on earth. The two of them have a loving relationship that fires everything else that has ever happened or ever will happen in the universe. And they're together again after 30 years. They've been in touch, but they're as together as beings could be at this point. And that changes everything. And that, to me, is the most important event of these days of unleavened bread. And that's why the next holy day, when God raises his family and gives them his Holy Spirit, and it's not the Omer anymore, it'll be tomorrow when we won't be in the Omer. We'll all be together, but sorry, no Omer. However, that day we wouldn't know when to keep if this hadn't happened. That day hangs on this day. That day is a satellite of this day, just like the moon is a satellite of our earth. And the only reason that we can begin God's family symbolically on that day of Pentecost is because of this and what it symbolizes, what actually happened 2,000 years later. And that's unusual because the other holy days have a dual meaning, don't they? Something happened a long time ago, and then something happened another long time ago. I mean, you know what I mean is the lamb was sacrificed, Jesus was sacrificed. There were trumpets blown. Jesus will come in the future with trumpets. There's a former and there's a latter. There's no former here. There's no former at all. It's just symbols that point. And that's why maybe that it's not a holy day or a festival all by itself. It's just something that takes place during one. But this is the important thing. The other things are important too, let's face it. We wouldn't have a life in God's family if it weren't for Jesus Christ's sacrifice. That's important. But I think I can speak for Jesus Christ when I say that he's much happier being alive. And that he, from that point on, is looking forward. The death was very important. It was crucial. Our lives, our understanding, the whole plan of God depends on it. But this event realigned the whole existence. And when I say existence, I don't mean just our universe. I mean all the other beings that aren't in our universe are suddenly realigned and everything's different. And what evil thought was going to happen isn't going to happen anymore because Jesus is back. And he's not just back, he's back with his Father. And they are a team again and life will go on. And that is the exciting thing about this time of year. And I like to imagine at this point that it was kind of a vacation for Jesus, that he'd done his job, you know? He wasn't quite retired. He wasn't ready for the recliner and the nap at this point. But Jesus, from this point on, things are different. After he's presented himself to his Father, before then, of course, understandably, he was the brooding Son of Man. He was the one in the book of Isaiah who it was prophesied that he would die. He knew that. And so he was very serious about his ministry those last few years, and he couldn't get the disciples to focus. And he gave them a hard time because they would say, no, 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 and he would say, yes. And he even said to Peter, he even called him Satan and said he was aligned with him because Peter was refusing to acknowledge that. So things were serious. I mean, the man sweated blood in the Garden of Gethsemane. It was a serious time. But after this, things are different. And I like to think that the sky was blue and the clouds were white and wonderful and the weather was nice because this was God's son and God could give him anything he wanted. And so Jesus does show up and he's nice to Mary and he's nice to the women and he goes and talks to his disciples. But he laughs with them and he said, Thomas, aren't you the one who said that you wouldn't believe me until you saw my wounds and put your hand in my side and stuff? Come here. And Thomas is going, no, no, it's fine, it's okay, it's okay. And Jesus is going, no, come here. And this is a man who has just walked through a wall. So he's got a little going for him at this point. So Thomas had to go there and touch things that no normal human being would want to touch. But he did it, and boy, did he remember it for the rest of his life. And because of that, so did everybody else. Jesus gives them a hard time. He goes out and yells while they're fishing and says, hey, catch anything? And they're, you know, that is not what you ask a fisherman. If a guy is fishing, you don't go up and say, doesn't look like you've caught anything, does it? They like to hear that. No, Jesus Christ yells to the boat. He knows they haven't caught anything, and he yells, catch anything? And they're going, and probably Peter said, no. And Jesus said, well, hey, I know I'm standing here, but pick up your nets and put them in on the other side of the boat. And they're going, there's always one in every crowd. There's somebody who thinks they know more, but they go, and suddenly at that point, of course, John and Peter, you get the idea, they've heard this before because they have. And they realized what was going on. And they dove in the water when they realized that. They did catch fish, by the way. They caught so many fish that the nets were breaking. But they dove in. Jesus was not only laughing at them because Peter, he didn't have any clothes on. I mean, the Bible's pretty clear about that. He comes dripping up on the shore, and Jesus has breakfast ready like any good friend would at that point. But Jesus is having a good time. And he makes fun of them. He comforts them. He walks with them. He has special things to say to his friend John, special things to say to his friend Peter. But you know what's most noticeable about these 40 days when Jesus was there after he'd presented himself to his father and come back? The most noticeable thing is he wasn't there most of the time. You'd think you have 50 days between wave sheaf offering and Pentecost. You have 40 days before you go back to your father. You'd think he would spend that time lecturing and giving out handouts and PowerPoints and things like that, that they would rent a hall and meet. But no, he's there from time to time. He shows up when they least expect it, but most of the time he's gone. What was he doing? Well, we'll all find out together in the world tomorrow. But I like to think that he was having a good time. That this earth he had created, and he had made it beautiful. He had put a lot of effort into this earth, and it was a gorgeous earth. And he'd been able to live there 33 years, but let's face it, he didn't get to travel much. He was busy for most of the time, and when he was there, it was in the Middle East, which is a wonderful place, I'm told. But, you know, there's no Grand Canyon, there's no rainforest, there's no China, there's no Australia, there's no Norway, there's no South Africa, there's none of these beautiful things. And he had 40 days left to be on the earth, and then he was going back, and it was going to be 2,000 years before he saw these again. I love to garden. I know many other people do here. I have my garden pretty much planted. Now it's a mess and things have to be pruned and things like that. But things are in. And I like to go out, particularly on a Sabbath, and I get two in a row to do this weekend, and things are all planted and all blooming. It's great. And I like to go out and look. And God did that too. When he planted a garden, he walked in it. Before Adam and Eve partook of the fruit, God was already in the habit of walking in the garden. He liked to look at things. He liked to see them. You take pride in what you've done. And Jesus, I like to think, used the time to sightsee. There's things that make me think that. One, that he was gone. But there are other things, because in the Bible, we don't understand. Talk about what Mr. Buttram was saying about a mystery. There are some mysteries in the Bible that we don't quite get. Remember Elijah, historical figure Elijah? Elijah would disappear from time to time and appear in other places. And this turned out to be a point of contention, because the king would send people to find him, and Elijah would disappear and go somewhere else, and then the king would show up where the guy had told him to go look for Elijah. Elijah wouldn't be there. He'd be in London at that point, you know, which didn't exist at that point. But he could have been anywhere. And the king, of course, would kill the person who told him where Elijah was. I mean, it was just his habit. We found that out. And finally, somebody came to Elijah and said, "Will you stay in one place so I can stay alive?" It says that in 2 Kings 1. That's what the guy said to him. Elijah could travel all over the place. It said the Spirit of the Lord came upon him and he would appear in different places. It names a few places. Philip was the same way in the New Testament. At least one time we know that he disappeared from one place and showed up in another place. We know that Elijah could run ahead of the king's chariot and be there when the king showed up. How is that even possible? We don't know. But God has his own way of letting people travel when they need to, apparently. I wonder myself about the man Enoch, because Enoch, as you know, walked with God. And the two things we know about Enoch are he walked with God. There's more than two things. He walked with God, and that he was translated at some point, both of which have to do with motion and starting out at one place and ending up in another place. And if you think I'm inaccurate about that, well, the word can mean many different things. You can use the same word about Elijah walking as a river moving on. When the waters receded during creation or after the flood, it was that same thing. They walked before God. So really, it's just motion. And it said that God spent many, many years with Enoch, about 300, walking with him. And that they had a good time. And I wonder, you know, God, at that point, the earth was young. Maybe he and Enoch traveled together. And one of the reasons, you may think this is totally crazy, but Enoch, over the years, over the millennia, has been identified with the Greek god Hermes. And some people think, well, Hermes came first and then Enoch came first and they identified with him, and other people think it's the other way around. Well, I don't know what you know about Hermes, but Hermes had wings on his sandals. They weren't real. It was fake. It was just a story. But it indicates that Hermes was known to travel, that he could travel very fast, that he could travel instantly and be in different places. That was his superpowers in the X-Men lineup of ancient Greece. Hermes could get around. Hermes could move, we could say, before God, because everything is before God. Why is Enoch identified with this? We don't know. But we know that at the end of his life, he was translated. He was in one place, and then he was in another place. We don't know exactly what that means, but it says that he was spared from death that way. Well, these are all possibilities with God, but Jesus wasn't there. And I like to think he was having a good time in the Arctic, watching the polar bears that he had made, in the Antarctic, watching the penguins that he had made, in the jungles of Borneo, watching orangutans that he had made, in the velds of Africa, looking at the magnificent beasts that he had made, in the United States, watching the beautiful wildlife, you know, the bison and the prairie life and all kinds of other things, and seeing the Rocky Mountains and the Canadian Rockies, and going to South America and seeing the beautiful landscapes there. I like to think he was using his time that way. That's not something I can prove. And in The World Tomorrow, there may be a special class on how Mark Graham was violently wrong about all this. But I also know that Jesus is my friend, and that when we reason things that are reasonable, that he approves of things like that. And so I'm willing to be corrected. But at the same time, you can just tell from his attitude that it was a very, very happy time for him. And because of this, the wave sheaf offering is of great value to us. And I'll tell you why. I don't know if you've thought about this before. Because there are many accounts of the New Testament trying to take the prophecies and the events in the Old Testament and making them fit into the Christian story. Like the Passover, like Noah and the Ark, like Days of Unleavened Bread. We do eat unleavened bread, but we look at it as a spiritual thing now. Like Feast of Trumpets, like Jesus being born of a virgin. And sometimes people feel that people in the New Testament, of course, I agree with what's written in the New Testament, but sometimes people feel a little too, people try a little too hard, and it's a little artificial to make it all work out that way, that sometimes the Hebrew doesn't support it. Well, this is a different case, because this is something that never happened. All we have is details, and when we get to the point where it did happen, there's no attempt to tie those details about Jesus coming back to life and going to see his father and being accepted. There's no attempt to tie that to the wave sheaf offering, other than Paul saying the thing about first fruits. So this is another shining proof, if you need more, that God's plan is the right one and that it does exist, because every detail of this was fulfilled without trying to fit it into the story. It's amazing the way that it happens. And as I said before, there's only a few people who actually understand that. I never heard or cared about the wave sheaf offering growing up in the church. It was one of those sacrifices. It isn't until you start looking at it in the context of the holy days that you start to see how important it is. Well, as I said, this is a wonderful, wonderful time of the year. We are in the Omer. We're on day 49. If I were you, I would have a picnic, because this is a day to have a good time. It's the time of year to have a good time. And Jesus had a good time. His disciples had a good time, as much as they could. And of course, then he left, and then 10 days took place, and then there was the day of Pentecost. And you'll hear more about that tomorrow. I sometimes wonder to myself how Jesus looks at the plan of God. And by that I mean, we talk a great deal about his crucifixion, about his dying, about his blood. And the reason we talk a great deal about it is it's really important and it really matters. But I wonder if it matters as much to Jesus as it does to us. And I don't mean anything belittling about that. But what I mean is Jesus moved on. Jesus had more of a plan, and when he comes back, it'll be about entirely different things. And I wonder sometimes, you know, when we meet Jesus in the world tomorrow, and we'll say to him things, oh, you know what, we really appreciate your sacrifice, we really appreciate the cleansing power of your blood, we really appreciate all that you did to realign the world and make it possible. And I kind of picture him going, thank you, I appreciate that very much. But it kind of reminds me of something that I heard this week from a man who stormed the beaches in Normandy on D-Day 75 years ago. And this man, he, of course, guess what? He's very old. He's in his 90s. And a reporter was talking to him, and he said, what would you say to the people today? And the man said, I would ask people if they've used what we gave them well. If they've used the time that we gave them, and if they used the opportunities and the life that we gave them, have they used them well? Well, I can hear Jesus saying the same thing. And the reason I can hear Jesus saying, what have you done with what I gave you? Yes, that's all important, and it was a big deal, but I have moved on. What have you done with what I gave you? And the reason I know he says that is because the Bible talks about it. You know, there's the parable of people receiving things from the master. And at the end, when the master comes back, what does the master ask? He says, what have you done with what I gave you? So it's something to keep in mind. Well, we have God's permission to rejoice on this 49th day of the Omer, and we have many, many, many reasons to rejoice. When we come back tomorrow, it'll no longer be the Omer, and we will move on. I was touched by the hymn that Mr. Mango led, page 83, the second one that we sang, because, of course, this is scripture. It comes from one of the Psalms, but it talks about what Jesus Christ will ask about. And the last verse, the last two lines of this hymn 83, it's singing about what God's people will do, and it's what we ought to be doing. We know this. It says, thy kingdom's glory they shall show, they shall thy power also tell, because we're talking about now what's coming. We have laid the foundation, but everything changed when Jesus Christ went back to his Father. So that men's sons his deeds may know, that's our commission, to make sure the world knows about it, his kingdom's grace that doth excel. So remember the things that we can learn from the wave sheaf offering and how important it is in our lives and in the plan of God, but especially in the lives of Jesus Christ and God. Keep in mind all the time the need to move forward and the need to move on to what the next holy days will picture. And always be grateful for that wave sheaf offering.